Nick, who do you got for the Masters this week?
All I can hope for it is to see Tiger win it.
If I told you a year ago today we'd be sitting down to discuss Tiger Woods winning the Masters in his 15th major, you would not have believed me, but here we are. Welcome to episode 10 of the Flagstick.com T-Talk podcast. My name is Stefan Tiedorf. Sitting across from me is the associate publisher of Flagstick.com and PGA of Canada professional Scott McLeod. Scotty, how are you doing today?
I'm enjoying the afterglow from this lovely Masters tournament.
What an amazing tournament. We'll get to the Masters in a second, but unfortunately, Nick's not here today. So if you're hearing this, I somehow was able to rig up something here to get some sound out of these microphones in the studio and make something work, but we're carrying on and we'll dive right into it.
We'll do it for Nick.
Doing it for Nick. And speaking of Nick, Nick was the only one that got it right. In last week's episode, we went over all of our picks of the tournament. My guy was Rory.
I took Ricky.
You had Ricky.
Wasn't too bad. He was sort of in the mix.
And Nick, only guy that had Tiger. I mean, I would love to hear his thoughts on what he was seeing. But
well, Mark Savard had Tiger too. So I guess it was two of them. So I guess the talent, the guys talking in the podcast, not the guest, not the producer, were the ones that figured it out. So I guess that says something about us.
I really realized today, I mean, I always knew Nick was a talent, but the hour and a half I spent just trying to get two microphones to work before this was a disaster. But what a tournament. That was amazing. As we said, Tiger Woods picks up his 81st win, but more importantly, his 15th major. Only three behind Jack now in a fashion that I don't think anybody saw coming. Nobody saw him winning this tournament. Let's be realistic. But here we are in... Wow, what a Sunday.
Yeah, I mean, if people had looked at it, like you said, a year ago, and you know, let's go back 2 years and think about the fact that this is a guy who couldn't crawl.
Two years ago at the championship dinner, he said, I don't think I'm ever playing golf again.
Yeah, so, I mean, how incredible is that? I mean, 2 years later, and I think I looked, I mean, he was somewhere, I don't know, in the range of the 600th ranked player in the world to start last year. He's up to sixth now. Yeah, unbelievable. I mean, you know, age 43. That gives us hope for a lot of us older guys, I guess.
Absolutely. What I think changed things for Tiger, and why I think he's destined for a giant run here, is in the past he would. I mean, he did have a lot of drives offline throughout the week, but he would drive it offline all weekend long and just make miraculous recovery shots. Where this week, if he needed to stripe it right down the fairway, he was just striping it right down the fairway. The one shot on after 12 when the two of them put it in the water and then he goes up to 13, I think you tweeted out, he only has 160 yards into that green. That was just the perfect drive after taking the lead. And he just drove it from there. He hit every single fairway, I think, on the way out, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, from that point, I mean, he had a couple little bobbles early, but if you look at his stats, he was okay for the week, much better than he normally has been, obviously with the driver. Took advantage of his iron play, which is always exceptional. I mean, players were talking about him on the range just flushing it, not missing a shot on the range, and he took that to the golf course. It was spectacular. I mean, you know, obviously he had some help, but that's the majors. And I mean, you know, the war of attrition that Jack Nicklaus used to do, you know, he'd try and wait out the other players and he'd just play steady. You know, that's sort of what Tiger did, especially heading into 12 there. He put on the gas a little bit after that, but to see four of the five other players that were in contention dump it in the water at Rays Creek and then him choose a more conservative route, it just showed, you know, sort of his brilliance, I guess.
Yeah, that was crazy. Who was it? It was Brooks put in the water.
Finau, Poulter. Yeah.
And then obviously Molinari.
Yeah.
And I think that's where, you know, Poulter is a vet. Molinari, I guess you can call him a vet, but I don't think he's necessarily a vet around Augusta. And Tony, this is his second time around there. And Brooks, you know, let's say five. I don't have the stats in front of me. Tiger knew what the vet move was to just, when you don't know what the wind's doing, hit it in between the two bunkers and you'll be happy regardless of where the pin is.
Yeah, I think experience obviously is important at Augusta National more than anything else. Especially for shots too, where you know you've got to have a safe shot. he actually played a draw. He actually played it left of the flag mm-hmm. and drew it a little bit left. And if you look at, you know, schematics of that hole and you see where you can hit it and where you can't, you know, that is a really safe spot. Granted, he did have to make a pretty clutch par putt to make his three out of there. But, you know, he was doing everything he could not to make five like a lot of the other players were doing.
Yeah, but as I said, you know, Molinari, yeah, he put one in the water. Tony put one in the water. Tiger just ho-hum. And then at that point, I think at that point for me, I knew it was over. He's never actually came back before.
No, never in a major. Yeah.
Which is a crazy stat. But I think he realized at that point, it's over. I'm locking this down because I'm not giving this lead back up.
Yeah, once he hit that shot on 16, and then, I mean, he was standing there watching it, and, you know, they obviously showed it on air as him chanting at that, getting close. That was it for me. I mean, you know, once you get up two strokes, yeah, sure, it could have gone sideways. And he said that as well. He said, you know, Arnold Palmer has lost it on 18 before. So, you know, he could still make a double bogey on 18 and obviously end up in a playoff. But
well, who's the guy that missed that 2-foot putt that one time?
Scott Hoke.
Yeah, Scott.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much what he had at the end there. I was nervous about that putt because they had the video of Scott.
I don't think everybody just sort of gave that to him either. I mean, if you looked at videos or things online, I saw one of a bar where everybody was there watching that 2-footer. They weren't celebrating before the 2-footer went in. They wanted to make sure that, you know, it wasn't some violent lip out or some wild thing. And even Tiger was staying as focused as possible. He said hitting his shot in there, even the pit shot, you know, he had some mud on the ball hitting the approach, and then, you know, he was not going to aim right at the pin. He was going to make sure that he was just on there, and, you know, he'd take his chances having a 2-putt. But incredible. I don't know where you were watching. You're watching at home, putting a dent in your couch.
Oh, I put a full dent in the couch. Actually, I got in a bit of trouble from last week's episode when I said it's not my fault your birthday fell on Masters weekend. But she actually sat down and watched the entirety of the final round and was thoroughly entertained from start to finish. I don't know how you couldn't be. But yeah, no, the couch had a full dent from Thursday afternoon right till Sunday. I don't think I left much.
I think you knew what a special week it was. I know for me, I was getting texts from people that just don't watch golf normally, and, you know, non-golfers that were, you know, sending messages, and they were watching Tiger. They like to watch Augusta. I happened to be watching with a number of industry people, and they were freaking out too. And, you know, it opened up a lot of questions too. A lot of people wondering, you know, what impact will it have on the sport? What, you know, what's it going to do as far as just eyeballs on the sport? And we saw that, you know, this week already. We saw the media storm, and I don't mean from the golf media. I mean from the mainstream media, just paying attention to golf, and because they know who Tiger Woods is. He's an identifiable character. He's had quite a history in the last little while. And that narrative really appeals to the mainstream media as well. So we'll see how this plays out, especially and how it's going to set up the year, right?
Everyone loves a comeback story. And this is one that you can't not like. The only person I talked to that wasn't happy with Tiger winning was my dad.
Why? He's not a fan?
No, he said he's never liked Tiger. I don't know why. Maybe he's always rooting for the underdog. He said he was cheering for Molinari, which, as in our fashion, in my family, whoever we're cheering for usually is the guy that's going to lose. So he just threw the curse on it. But he's the only guy I knew that wasn't cheering for Tiger all week.
You know, there's definitely some people that, you know, whether they weren't Tiger fans because of his golf aspect or his personal struggles, whatever the case may be, not everybody is a Tiger fan. That's not the case. And really, for me, it really comes down to just respecting someone's ability more than anything. I put up a poll right afterwards talking about Jack in 86 and Tiger this year. It really wasn't meant to do a comparison. It was meant to sort of people to say, you know, here's the thing I didn't think I'd see again in my lifetime, being, you know, 16 when the Jack moment happened in 86, and just wondering what people's personal impressions were more than anything, but not saying one was greater than another. And that was a big talk this week. A lot of people going, you know, is this the greatest sports comeback ever? And there's a ton of different comebacks in various types of sports and different ways and different matters. And you know, all time's a long time. So yeah. trying to, I guess a lot of people got excited in the heat of the moment, but in the end, I think a few people responded back to me in a way where they said, you know what? Just enjoy it. There's no real reason to compare it. And I think I'm sitting right there with that now too.
I agree. I think the biggest difference between Tiger in 2019 and Jack in 1986 is, I believe Jack in 1986 would have said it as well, is I think he knew that was the last hurrah. And it was, I think everyone had that feeling. It was like, this is super special,
yeah.
But it's not going to happen again. He's not going to go out and win the next, you know, 2 to 3, whatever. Where I think Tiger, he still is a little bit younger and he's a freak athlete. He's always been a freak athlete. And I don't think anybody's counting him out at this point. He's definitely not.
Yeah, I mean, Nicklaus had a couple of brushes, you know, at Augusta even after that, but I don't think it was anything that people really thought was a legitimate chance. So I certainly agree with that. I think what everybody, you know, is looking at now is, yeah, you know what, Tiger won the Tour Championship last year. He just won Augusta. He said he's not going to play as heavy a schedule as he did last year. He's going to be really focused. But obviously, he's got the game to beat the best players in the world. We're not talking, you know, a bunch of no stiffs, names. Yeah, these are not a bunch of stiffs that he went through. And I mean, you can just look at that leaderboard. It was a crazy leaderboard. And he beat them. He didn't, you know, yes, a few guys hit some balls here and there, some wayward shots, but everybody's going to do that. But, you know, in the end, he made those three birdies coming home to beat them and to win that 15th major and not, it wasn't handed to him. He went out and got it. And I think you're right. That leaves everybody wondering, what's it going to be like for the rest of the year? I mean, now 15's done. Is 18 in play again?
I think we'll get to that in a bit because there are some spicy venues this year that we can get to. One thing to look at here is the bottom four guys are guys, I mean, they're not all Tiger's age, but they're some of the older guys out there. And Tiger obviously played a lot with Vijay. I don't know how much carryover he would have had with guys like Woosnam and then Angel Cabrera. Guys like that, he had a little bit
with Cabrera, but I mean Casey was right there too. I mean, there was a big surprise. There's a guy we talked about as a possible pick. I don't think we jumped in with him. We did mention him.
Yeah, shot. He won off the high for the first day. Yeah. A nice little 81.
Yeah, I didn't see any much coverage about that. No. Obviously, he wasn't brought into the media room, so I don't know if there's something happened there as far as an injury or something, but certainly uncharacteristic play based on what he's been doing of late, right?
Yeah, no, that was unfortunate to see that. You know, we love Paul Casey on here. Couple of the past Masters champions, Danny Willett, Sergio Garcia, they're right down near the bottom there, which is unfortunate. I don't, you know, Danny Willett, I know we talked about him a little bit. I think this is all you're really going to see of him. I don't know what's going on there. Don't need to speculate. And then Sergio's had his demons on the golf course this year, unfortunately. But our other picks that we went over going into the tournament, I picked Rory to win the tournament. I said he's going to win a major at some point this year, and he was pretty much irrelevant until Sunday. Kind of made a late push, but
he did,
but nothing really.
No.
You had Ricky, same kind of deal.
Yeah, Ricky kind of surprised me, but he had a couple of bobbles in there, but he certainly perked up in that middle of the back nine on Sunday, made four birdies there in five holes, but unfortunately made a bogey on 18, which wouldn't have mattered anyways. I mean, it would have been the difference between T9 and T5, but I still think he played well. I still think he's got the ability to win a major. Is that going to be this year? He's going to have to get over the hump somehow because, you know, T9 is close, but it's not close enough, really.
The best part about this tournament was starting on Thursday, this leaderboard was stacked, and it was stacked on Friday, and it was stacked. Like, if you look at one point, the first page of the leaderboard on TV, I believe it was on Saturday, they said every person on there is a major champion.
Yeah, it was incredible, actually.
Oh, it was so cool. And that was the best part. Any of these guys could win. if you asked me where Dustin Johnson finished, I would be like, oh, he's probably close to the top. He finished one stroke back. Shoffley, yeah, one stroke back. Koepka, one stroke back. Jason Day almost pulled out after two holes with a back injury from picking up his kid. Two strokes back. Like, just a stacked, stacked leaderboard. We talked about Molinari on the last show as kind of a dark horse pick. And we also talked about Tony Finau as a dark horse pick, or, a, you know, not a dark horse pick, but one down from the top tier.
Yep.
And both of them right in it, right till the end.
Yeah, and Shoffley, I think he was kind of the guy that was threatening a little bit. I thought, you know, I was sitting with a couple of guys and they're like, Shoffley could be the guy, especially the way he plays par fives. And 12, he was close.
That guy's got game. He's got a major in him for sure.
You would think so. I mean, he'd already won a tour championship already as a rookie. He's got a ton of talent. Where his golf skills match up to for as far as a major course, they obviously match up to Augusta. So, it could be a case that he contends here again next year. You know, Koepka is a guy that, you know, destroys the par fives. I mean, just destroys them.
He's still somehow underrated.
I know. He's just, I think, I don't know. I think it's just his, maybe it's just his attitude a little bit. I mean, I think when you're a little bit more outgoing and a little bit more flamboyant, I mean, not that, you know, a guy like Molinari is flamboyant or anything like that, but I think the aw shucks.
You mean he's not Molinari?
No, I mean, he really doesn't say a lot, really. And I understand that. But you know, Koepka, I think, you know, going in, a lot of people were dismissing him. I think I even dismissed him a bit, which I think I'm going to give myself a kick in the head over that one. I don't think you can dismiss him anytime. He's just too talented. Unfortunately, that double on 12 derailed him and made the difference between, being there and not being there.
Did any media member have a worse weekend than Brandel when he called out Koepka on Wednesday call? I forget what he said, basically self-sabotage for him losing weight. And then he goes out and misses by one stroke to win the whole thing. Just a swing and a miss on that one.
You know, I hate it sometimes, unfortunately. You know, as a media member, I see lots of people's different approach to going about and doing things. And, you know, he's welcome to do that if he wants to go on and take it on. Shane Ryan is a writer who talked about, you know, Tiger being totally done a few years ago. And, you know, he had an article that was a little bit of an act of contrition. I think yesterday it came out basically saying, yeah, I was wrong or whatever. But, you know, he also admitted in that article as well that, you know, he may as well said it, I write for clickbait more than anything. And he said, well, I write for views. So unfortunately, a lot of people put stuff out there just because they know it will cause some controversy and it will get some attention, rather than just saying, you know, making a wise choice. Or just choosing to shut up, really.
Absolutely. And I, at the end of the day, they have so many hours they have to fill on TV.
True.
But this was just a big miss. Like, the guy can play regardless. They say when he was in the gym too much, he's too big. He's not eating, he's too small. Like, it was just back and forth. You can't win.
There's too much of the flavor of the day that happens.
Exactly.
And we see that, you know, I won't say it's just TV. We hear it in radio and other shows and podcasts and everything as well. You know, they'll come in here now and, you know, it doesn't matter who the player is. I mean, a couple of years ago, Bubba wins 2 out of 3 years. And next thing you know, they say, oh, could this guy win, you know, 10 Masters? Yeah. And they just get overly excited. And we've seen lots of young players that, you know, they get their first win. And, you know, there's a guy like Patrick Cantlay who, you know, one, and then people are going, oh, this guy could win 20 times. And well, you know, predictions, unfortunately, are just not a really safe thing to jump into, because there's just too many factors that will determine what an outcome could be.
I mean, I can eat some crow for Molinari, right? I said,
sure,
I didn't see him as a factor in the Masters. And that's when you record your takes and put it out there to the world. They're out there forever. And boy, was I wrong on him. So.
But I mean, what do you think about him for another major? I mean, he's obviously won an Open Championship. I mean, +2 in the final round, mostly caused by the debacle on 12 for sure. But I mean, this guy was so clutch. I mean, the putts.
My one buddy, he said something like, this guy could go out, close his eyes, and shoot 69 and win by 4. It was like, like, that's how it felt.
It looked that way for a while. Yeah,
he'd go up,
for sure.
He'd miss a putt. It'd be 8 feet by, and I'd just be like, it's in. It doesn't matter. Yeah. It's in. It's going in.
And they weren't like catching the side or whatever. They were pure right in the middle.
He might be the best putter on tour right now.
it would be hard to argue.
I don't have the stats in front of me. I'm just throwing that.
He's certainly the most reformed. And I think I said that last week, that he's a different Molinari than was there before. He's not the same Molinari. He's not the same player that he was before. He's got that extra yardage now. That putter is just, you know, it's an equal for anyone. I mean, it doesn't matter what he does. Unfortunately, you know, you still can't make mistakes in majors, right?
No, and speaking of major championships, you know, I know people are, you know, there's recency bias here, but people are looking ahead to the next couple here and the venues that are set up. And these are all venues that Tiger Woods has won on. We have Bethpage Black coming up next at the PGA Championship in May. Tiger has obviously won at that course. What are your thoughts going into the PGA?
You just can't discount him. I mean, there's going to be so, I mean, I don't know how much he's going to be playing between now and then, but no matter what the case is, there are going to be so much buildup going into that. You know, of course, he can handle it. It's no big deal for him, but there will be a lot of buildup when all of a sudden people now are talking about grand slams and all sorts of things. You know, it'll just be fun to watch. It'll be fun to see. It'll be, you know, the New York crowd will be going crazy again. You know, they're going to be going nuts because it's Tiger. It's certainly not going to hurt attendance at any tournament that he's at this year. And for him to go into, you know, Bethpage, Pebble Beach, I mean, God, he's destroyed Pebble Beach over the years.
Won 2000 there for the U.S. Open.
Yeah, so, I mean, those two alone, you know, the wild card is going to be Port Rush. It's a golf course. I'm going to get to check that out in a couple weeks.
So I'm going to get
to see it.
Any extra spots yet?
Not that I know of, but I'll be very interested to go over. Not that I can make a major assessment of how that golf course is going to, you know, suit Tiger's game, but at least to be able to look at it and get on the grounds and kind of see what it's like. It's going to be different later in the year as far as if it firms up and it'll play quite differently, but it'll be interesting to see. And, you know, with his little ability now to, you know, hit a little bit more control off the tee, I can't see that hurting him over there, that's for sure.
I was going to say that's something he's going to need at Bethpage Black for sure, because that's a course that if you miss the fairway, you're looking square in the eye at one.
Yeah, the nice part about Tiger's game and the experience of winning 15 majors now and 81 PGA Tour events.
That's weird to say, eh?
It is weird to say. I didn't know if we'd ever be able to say that. You know, we thought you'd be stuck on 14 forever. But to think that he's looking at 16 now, but that experience makes a huge difference for those majors, you know, not to be impatient. I mean, he didn't make a double bogey this week. You know, he made a point of saying that's important. Yeah. You know, bogeys you can recover from, doubles really sting you. So even if he gets a little offline at Bethpage, a little bit, I'm not saying he can, you know, hit it around the planet, because obviously there's 4 foot, you know, grass that's waiting to grab you there and nasty bunkers and things. But he's patient enough to lob it out there, hit the shot up, make the putt. I mean, did you see him really get upset all week?
He was just chewing his gum.
Just chewing his gum.
Like, is there an ad? There's got to be an ad coming out this week of him on Excel or Trident.
So. Yeah.
Something's coming.
Yeah,
here.
You would think so. But, you know, he said it was a lot to do with, you know, he's not eating as much now. It keeps him from eating
He's got a little bit of a paunch now, I noticed. Can we get into the outfit, though? Like, come.
don't like the mock neck or the
to
red?
All, to any of the
red's good. Mock
the
neck.
Red, yeah. But to all the, like, the grit grinders out there, the bigger lads that think they're going to go out and buy this mock neck t-shirt looking
thing. I think
they're
too late. I think they're already sold out everywhere. So
don't do it. You're going to look terrible. Let's be honest. Tiger looked terrible in it, but he won the tournament. If he didn't win the tournament, that's all we'd be talking about. How silly he looked. But
yeah, you know what? If there's a guy that can pull it off, it's him.
Yeah, what are you
going to
say?
It's the Tiger uniform, right? It's, you know, that's just what it is. But that doesn't mean people need to show up wearing it. That's for sure. So
no, and he was the only one in the field field doing it. And also, there was something else that was in the field. I don't ever remember seeing a colored golf ball at Augusta National. And we had Bubba Watson out there playing a yellow Pro V1.
Yeah. You know, Bubba's Bubba. That's just the way
That's
he is.
Bubba Golf.
He made the switch back to Titleist after his ill-fated journey with the Volvic golf ball that didn't work out well.
It was a rough year.
It was a rough year for him. Went to the Pro V. And yeah, he's one of the guys now that's playing a yellow. But I mean, seeing a yellow ball at Augusta, it's kind of cool.
It's kind of cool. My Uncle George, he's been talking about switching to yellow golf balls for years. And my dad always would get after him. Oh, you know, you don't see the guys out on the tour using yellow golf balls. Well, now you can get a Pro V1 in yellow and, you know, show them up there.
This is probably a good time to transition to our guest this week. It's Michael Mahoney, who's Titleist Vice President of Golf Ball Marketing. Interesting guy. Had a chance to sit down with him a couple weeks ago. He came up to Canada to do a presentation, and we talked about all the new things with Titleist with their new 2019 Pro V1, the yellow Pro
and
V1.
Yellow. They also have white. Don't forget, you can still get a white one.
You can. Also the AVX ball, all the other products in their product line, but not just about the marketing aspect. We talked about the heritage as a company, what it's all about, all sorts of different things that are really relevant to people, you know, finding out more about the company and its heritage. So how about we go to the interview right now? First off, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Why don't you introduce yourself and let us know sort of what's your role at Titleist?
Yeah, so I'm Michael Mahoney. I'm VP of Golf Ball Marketing, but what does that actually mean? What do I do every day? I have responsibility for a few different things at Titleist. I have responsibility for product management. So our product management team spends kind of all day, every day, thinking about getting golf balls from what do golfers want and what does R&D have to offer to golf shops. So that's a really fun part of the job. The marketing piece of it is all the things we do to really position the product. And then I also have responsibility for digital marketing. So a lot of the stuff that we, you know, golfers see out on social media, Facebook, Instagram, all the stuff we do at Team Titleist.
So what you're saying, it's a big job.
It's a big job. I have a lot of people who are much smarter than me who do all the heavy lifting, but it's a fun job for sure.
In that aspect, it's always more fun when you have lots of new products. And obviously you're here in Canada talking about some of the new products, specifically the Pro V1, the Pro V1X,
yes,
and maybe the AVX a little bit as well. But why don't you tell us a little bit about what's different for 2019
sure.
in the Pro V1, Pro V1X family?
Yeah, so our we're very fond of saying that our process in terms of how we get from one product launch to the next is that it starts and ends with golfers. So what golfers told us coming out of the last Pro V1 launch was that they were looking for more distance. We delivered that in 2017 Pro V1, and golfers said, geez, if you could do more of that with both golf balls without changing any of the flight, feel, and spin characteristics.
That's simple, right?
Yeah, simple.
Yeah.
We do that. And the other thing we heard loud and clear was that golfers were ready for a yellow Pro V1. So the really the pursuits were built around distance and delivering yellow. And so the resulting product that we brought to market, both on Pro V1 and Pro V1X, can really be boiled down to the statement that we gave them more speed, more consistency, more precision by adding more of what's fast into the product technology-wise and taking away some of the material that was slower, if you will. So more of what's fast, less of what's not, gets you more distance and maintains that slight feel and spin characteristics, and now both are available in yellow. So
how do you get it down to those wants and needs from the consumers? Obviously,
yeah,
there's a bit of a process there.
Yeah, going back to sort of that product management part of my job, I think that's one of the things both myself and the team that works on that enjoy the most is we spend a ton of time talking to golfers. And that's everybody from tour players all the way down to, you know, an average player who is just trying to get, you know, incrementally better, break 100 for the first time and that kind of thing. And we listen to them and talk to them about what they're looking for. It helps us not only take a look at the data that we receive, but it also gives us the opportunity to put into context what they're asking for in terms of new products. So really it's put the golfer at the center and just listen to them.
Yeah, I mean, there's no sense of you just making a product thinking you know what's best, but it's better to listen to that consumer, right?
Yeah, that's right. Although I will say one of the things that's interesting about what we do, and I think an advantage that we have in terms of the investment we make on the research side, is that product innovations come from two things. One is the golfer telling you, this is what would make my product better, and then you go chase that. The other is the R&D team has some sort of a breakthrough innovation that the golfer wouldn't even know to ask for, and you give them that, and AVX is actually a pretty good example of that, where they, once you deliver it to market, the golfer wasn't specifically asking for it, and when they get it, they go, wow, this is exactly what I need.
Yeah. I mean, it was a markedly different ball than what was offered previously. But,
that's right.
You know, when you hit it, you went, ooh, okay, this could be a really good fit for certain golfers, right?
Yeah, what we saw with AVX was there was, and any golfer who's paid attention to what's gone in the golf ball space over the last 5 or 6 years, even probably longer than that, has been a trend towards softer products. The fundamental problem with softer, particularly when it comes to compression, is that it can rob the product of performance. It can take spin away, and it can take speed away.
Yeah.
And so what AVX delivered was a softer golf ball that didn't rob the golfer of that performance, delivered that, you know, what golfers would expect from a golf ball in terms of spin characteristics in that category, what golfers would expect from a golf ball in terms of speed in that category, and really, in particular, long iron distance. So that was all through a bunch of work that the R&D team did that really was born out of like a long lead kind of project and research.
Now, you mentioned yellow in there. How difficult a process was it to make yellow happen?
For us, it was a significant undertaking. And the reason for that is that, and not everybody necessarily understands the complexity that goes into making Pro V1 and Pro V1X. For us, because we make our own urethane, because our urethane is something that is made at the point of production in our factories, not something we order from a supplier, which the majority of urethane products out there are, it required complex chemistry to get there. The other thing is, it's not just, hey, well, I want yellow, so any yellow will do. Getting the, you know, that really pristine yellow that we think looks incredible is, and golfers told us they picked, was part of the process. And so it's really, there's three elements that go into making the yellow Pro V1 and Pro V1X look the way it does. First is actually the casing layer itself has to be a certain shade because the cover itself is a little bit translucent. So light goes in, travels
so
through.
It'll impact the
overall
color. Yeah,
that's right. So that the casing layer has a color to it. The cover itself, obviously, is yellow urethane. And then we put a high reflective pearl coating over the top that, so once it gets up in the sunlight, you get that great reflectivity of it. So it's really three different elements that contribute to the final sort of visible appearance.
One thing that I always noticed about Titus, or noted, I went to the original ball plant in 1993, which obviously is gone now, which is unfortunate because I wish people would actually go back and see that.
Yeah.
I know you started to do some consumer tours in the ball plants, and obviously you've had a lot of tour players and things there over the years. Why don't you share a little bit about what the response normally is from people? I know what my own personal response is. I mean, people will talk to me and they say, you know, golf balls cost X and wow, it's so much. And I say, well, you know what? Do one ball plant tour and you will not you'll think they're worth $150 a dozen, right?
Well, I'm glad you said that before I did, because it always sounds so self-serving when I say, well, the biggest thing people say when they walk out is, boy, you guys don't charge enough, which I don't think anybody really thinks, but that it does tell you what, when you go in and you know, the challenge of making you name it in sort of the consumer products that we find in our lives is, you look at golf balls and you go, I don't know what's behind it. I don't know what complexity goes into it. And you kind of look at them, they're white, they're round, they have dimples. When you walk through the ball plant, I think the things that strike people the most is, one, the attention to detail and the number of different steps that goes into it. But two, and I think this is, for me, one of the things I like the most about giving tours to anybody who comes to see the plant is, I routinely have people comment about their interaction with the people on the floor. Yeah, at Ball Plant 3 in New Bedford, the average tenure of somebody is over 20 years making golf balls for us. And so there's an incredible pride in what they do. And, you know, if you take a tour and you're walking through, you're inevitably going to have somebody who stops and says hello to you or, you know, asks you where you're from. And I think that that, you know, there's a lot of things you can do process-wise. There's a lot of great technology into, mm-hmm. that goes into making golf balls. But, you know, I always think that the difference between truly, truly great products and average products is that the people behind them have an incredible passion and commitment to it. And that's definitely true in the Ball Plant.
It's kind of funny because when you said that, all I could think of was, again, back to Ball Plant number one. And I can remember this lady bouncing cores back in the original Baladas, you know, with the mixture of corn syrup and water or whatever that was in there. And you're right. And I had that obviously going to FootJoy as well. Yes. Some of the people that used to work in the Classics plant that had worked there for decades and decades, whether it was the old shoemaker guy who did the spikes in the bottom of the shoes. So, you know, there's an authentic aspect to it as well. It's not just about technology. As you said, they're putting their own sort of labor into it, their pride into it, and that's a part of the piece as well, right?
It is. You kind of think, okay, well, we're going to make and design a golf ball, and then we're going to go make it in the plants. A lot of times, the question is not, okay, just go do this, or it's figure out how to do this. And so there's definitely there's a great room in the back of R&D that's a machine shop. And, you know, a machine shop for a golf ball manufacturer, why do you need that? Well, they do a ton of work in that area, literally making contraptions that look like something out of, you know, a science fair on steroids.
Yeah.
That's where our short game robot for testing short game shots came out of. And it's literally, you look at it and you go, is that a part from a bicycle? And you go, yep, that actually is a part from a bicycle. Yeah. So there is this level of almost sort of like, let's go figure it out. Mm-hmm. And that's true when you're talking about, okay, well, we want to, the new Pro V1, we want to make the cover thinner and the casing layer thicker. Sounds like, okay, well, it sounds pretty easy. Well, making the cover 20%, almost 20% thinner requires a bunch of people sitting around and going, so how would we do this? What if we try this? What if we try that? What if we built this little piece on the finishing line? You know, that those are the types of experiments and explorations that go on that make it fun and sort of, you know, it does feel like a challenge and a problem to solve for the people who have been there for a long time.
Now, obviously, you have an opportunity to test golf balls with, as you said, consumers, tour players, and things like that. Where does the testing process that, you know, you have Manchester Lane, you have the facility to make use of, which is an amazing facility, and even better when they added the short game area to it. But how does that fit into that process as far as experimenting with the balls and finding out what results?
So for us, prototyping is really an iterative process that we go through. So, you know, on the whole speed pursuit for Pro V1 and Pro V1X, we had a bunch of different teams doing work. Some were doing core work, some were doing casing work, some were doing aerodynamic work, and they're doing those independently and testing the golf balls. And then when we saw results, we'd come back and we basically built a prototype that took pieces of all of that. All throughout that, not only are we doing testing in the lab and with robots, but we're going to take those out on the golf course. And whether it's sending a batch out to Team Titleist members and asking them to give us feedback, or it's, you know, on any given week on the PGA Tour. I mean, we have two members of the Titleist Golf Ball R&D team who are on tour every single week. And the PGA Tour, the web, LPGA, and they travel around. And the way it works is Monday through Wednesday, you know, you stand on the range and, you know, Bubba Watson is, hey, I'm going out to play nine holes and 40 pits. One of those R&D guys grabs Bubba and says, hey, would you mind, could I walk a few holes with you? Yeah. And it's literally putting golf balls down in the middle of a fairway and saying, okay, hit three with your ball and then hit three of this prototype. What do you see? And collecting that feedback. So it is. It's a very hands-on, direct kind of conversation.
And why don't you explain a little bit, too, about how precise that feedback is sometimes. I know at one point I talked to Lee Westwood.
Yeah.
I think it was a switch. could have been the 15 to 17, you know, but he was talking about a 5-foot window that he was looking at with his driver that he liked or didn't like. I forget what it was, but, you know, how precise is that feedback that you get from those players?
Well, from the tour players, it's incredibly precise. But it's also what I find most interesting about tour players is I think one of the clear unifiers of all golfers is that they are fickle and different, and what matters to them, you know.
It doesn't matter if they're on tour or they're
exactly.
a 30 handicapper.
That's
right.
You go talk to a 30 handicap, and they go, well, you know what? Flight is really important to me. And then you go to another golfer of the same ability, and they go, flight? I don't care about flight, you know. And that's true on tour, too. But on tour, the precision of the feedback of that one's flying a little bit higher, or that feels a little bit firmer, or sounds a little bit different. You know, I mean, I can remember, I won't say the tour player's name, a guy who... once gave us, Forty and I were, I was out testing with him, and we're hitting short game shots, and his comment was, that one's stopping on the wrong bounce. And Forty and I looked at each other and went, not sure we can fix that for you. So
you can do miracles, but maybe not that much. Yeah.
It's spinning and stopping on the wrong bounce. Okay, all right.
Does that make it hard, though, when you go out, you know, especially in different conditions? Because obviously golf courses are not consistent. You're able to do a lot of testing out west and Oceanside or whatever and see very consistent conditions, which a lot of people maybe don't understand why golf manufacturers and the Carls are in the Carlsbad area, but it is for that consistent environment. But does that make it difficult then when you're going to, you know, talk to a golfer who's been playing in soft conditions on the West Coast and then they're going to firmer conditions and you got to blend that all in there too, right?
I think what we try to balance is we know we can get testing in perfect and controlled conditions at Manchester Lane at TPI out on the West Coast, hitting on robots or hitting with players in that environment. But you know, golf is played in the golf course, and so that is one of the reasons we think you know, to be able to go out and over the course of, you know, following the tour, you know, start in the early part of the year out in the West Coast and you know, moving through the desert, going to Florida, and then as sort of the season opens up, following players around and doing different testing and tracking that and seeing, you know, what are players commenting on during, in these types of conditions, you know, firm and fast versus, you know, wet and slow, and those different things that we see help us better understand that. But, you know, we know that the product we're going to go and put in their lockers every week or put in any golfer's locker around the world is also going to show up and have to be hit, you know, in conditions that vary all over the place. And we're trying to get golf balls and really generally a Titleist golf equipment that performs in all those conditions.
Most players would obviously make a choice, one ball or the other. Would you ever see a variance, you know, for a tournament where a player might switch up a golf ball? I mean, that's a question I've heard from some consumers that say, you know, would a player make a switch?
We generally speaking, don't get a lot of players who do that. Only because, you know, as we say, with the golf ball, what we're trying to do is build a piece of equipment that performs optimally on every shot throughout the bag. Now, that said, if you were talking to Aaron Dill, you know, who makes wedges out on tour every week, you know, he'll see when he goes over to the Open Championship, you know, players adjusting for those conditions and even, you know, players making adjustments based on agronomy and the types of grass and how firm, you know, whether players are mixing a wedge with more or less bounce into their bag. Generally speaking, we see players tend to stick. Now, that I think they do tend to make golf ball changes, but oftentimes that has more to do with, you know, what's going on in their game or what they're trying to do, but less on the conditions.
Now, when we talked about consumers, you were doing a little presentation here today, and I think you had a very interesting bit of data that was there. You mentioned a test that you did at the Cradle, which is the short course at Pinehurst. Can you tell us a little bit about that and what those results were?
You know, I think one of the most common questions we get is, can Pro V1 really make a difference in my game? And that, oftentimes that question comes from a higher handicap player. And so we wanted to do an exploration and see what impact does the golf ball have on people's ability to score. And we focus, when we talk about scoring, on shots basically into and around the green. So we thought, what better place to test this than the short course at the Cradle at Pinehurst, which, you know, is about a 700 yards long, nine-hole golf course. Truly Pinehurst, rolling greens. It's a really cool place. They've done such a good job.
And you have to have a good short game if you're going to score, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So what we did was we took a bunch of Team Titleist members. We evenly distributed them into two groups by handicap. So we had a mix of players in each group. Half the group got a golf ball with a red dot on it. Half a group got a golf ball with a green dot on it. And we said, okay, go play, keep score, and turn them all in. What came back was scores that we got, and half the group, that red dot group, was playing Pro V1, half the group was playing green dot, which was a basically a two-piece distance construction, a low spin distance ball. And the scratch players, their average score is about even par with the Pro V1 group, and the players who play with the green dot were about a half shot higher. Okay. As handicap goes up, we saw that gap increase, and in fact, the higher handicap group had a four-shot difference in terms of what the Pro V1 group shot versus what the distance ball group shot. And
so in essence, it helped that player more.
It helped that player more, and you know, we were talking about nine holes, 700 yards, and if you kind of play that out and say, okay, every single one of these shots that they're hitting into the green, set up on a tee or, you know, an imperfect lie and that sort of thing. We don't get to do that on the golf course. So imagine if you just sort of play that out and say, so for a 15 handicap who I'm going to give you a product that I think can maybe save you 8 or 10 shots around, mm-hmm. you know, they'd go, okay, yeah, I'll pay whatever you want. Give it to me. Well, we saw, and again, maybe not promising every player is going to experience that exactly.
It'd be
that.
Nice to guarantee it that, would. Wouldn't it?
But time and time again, we see players who put Pro V1 in the bag, and we say, commit to it. Play, you know, you've been playing anything in the bag, or you've been playing a low spin distance ball. Put Pro V1 in the bag for 2 months, and you know, see what happens to your handicap. See what happens to your scoring. And play it every time. Don't, you know, a lot of people say, oh, Pro V1's the ball I play when it really counts, you know. One of the things we say to people all the time, you got to know what the ball's going to do, you know. So play the same product every single time. I don't care what it is. Play the same one every time. So,
and I was going to ask about that. I mean, that's something that does happen in a lot of players that will go, you know, I'll see them go over to the putting green and they'll be chipping over there with, you know, with a range ball. And then they go out in the golf course and then they, you know, use something, their good ball.
Yeah, right.
And they get a totally different result and they say, well, I'm not good enough to see the difference.
Right.
But you guys have done enough testing. That's not really the case, right?
Definitely not. No, any golfer who, the other example we use all the time is people who say, oh, I can't tell the difference because I hit one in the woods and lost it and then pulled a different ball out of my bag and played on. I didn't know notice the difference. Very few golfers could tell the difference testing that way. Line golf balls up side by side and hit a variety of shots and you're going to see those differences. But to your point too, that particularly when you're talking about short game practice with the ball you play. You know, I mean, if you're sitting there hitting, you know, even just 30-yard shots into a green and you're practicing with a range ball, the spin characteristics on that ball have no relationship to the ball you're playing in your bag. And you're going to say, oh, well, I'm hitting all those close because I'm hitting them, you know, 10 yards shorter than I would with my ball, and it's rolling up and getting close. Oh, good. That's great. Well, yeah, but that's not the shot you're going to go try to hit on the golf course. So practice with the ball you play.
Now, what level of studies have you guys done on regards to putting? I mean, we talked about short game as far as wedges and performance that way. But, you know, where does the ball come into play as far as putting and how consumers sort of perceive it and make choices, I guess?
So it's funny. I can remember our longtime head of R&D on the golf ball side, Bill Morgan, used to say, you know what? Once we get to the green, I let Scotty take over. So to that point, one of the things that we find with putting and the golf ball is feel. And when we say feel, really what that relates to on the green is sound, is a big, big factor. But, the only thing that can affect putting relative to the golf ball is if there's inconsistencies in terms of concentricity of the core, if they're out of round, they can create inconsistent roll. But all Titleist golf balls, do so much to make sure that they meet our quality standards, they're all going to essentially perform the same. Now, if you go practice with a DT TrueSoft and then you go and you putt with a Pro V1X, you might go, these perform different. Well, they sound and feel completely different coming off the face, and you may end up actually, you know, needing to adjust to that. Right. But it's really more about feel than anything else.
Now, we've talked a lot about Pro V1, Pro V1X, a little bit about AVX as well. They're not your only golf balls. So right. Where do the other golf balls fit, and why would they fit other yeah. consumers?
So the first thing I would say is the whole goal for what we do in terms of the golf ball line is to deliver any product we have in the line, have it be the best performing in the segment that it competes. We talked till we're blue in the face about how we think any golfer benefit from Pro V1, Pro V1X, or AVX. And so the logical question that you just asked, so why make any other ones? Well, because we know that golfers have preferences. And one of those preferences is price. So while we think it'd be worth it for any golfer to play Pro V1 who's trying to play better, we know that there are different segments of the market, and we want to deliver the best performing ball we can. So we have TourSoft, which is a high-performance, terrific golf ball that we use technology that is less expensive and complex as what we put into Pro V1 and Pro V1X. So you get really good performance in that golf ball. In fact, performance that when we measure it, it outperforms a lot of the urethane, multi-layer urethane products it competes against. But, you know, it's just at a different price. Velocity, which, you know, if you don't understand what velocity is for, then we maybe need to go
back
to
the name.
It's kind of a grammar school thing, right? Yeah. Yeah. So that's our take on distance, and it delivers on it. It's low spin, it's high speed, and it's long on every shot. And then DT TrueSoft, which really has kind of two purposes in the line. One, it's the softest of any Titleist golf ball on the line, and it's also the entry price point. So we try to not only have a golf ball that's the best performing in every segment, but we also try to have a golf ball lineup where a golfer walks up to a Titleist display, they kind of know what everyone is for. Right. I think, you know, walking into today's golf shop for a golfer can be completely overwhelming because there's so many choices, there's so many different options, and so while we can't control what the competition does in terms of different SKUs and positioning and all that stuff, we hope that if you just look at the Titleist golf ball lineup, there's sort of a golf ball and story behind each one, and it makes logical kind of sense at how they fit together.
Last question for you,
yeah.
And we're sort of going to loop back a little bit. Obviously, the company now over 80 years. How do you tie into that heritage? I mean, if we look at the origin of the golf ball, and you mentioned a little yeah. bit earlier, you were talking about centeredness of balls
yeah.
and things like that. And that's kind of a unique piece that maybe not everybody is aware of. You've used it a little bit in your yeah. marketing over the years. But, you know, how do you sort of blend that in from a marketing side of it and go, you know, here's what we actually started to do at the yeah. very beginning, and this is what we're all about.
Yeah, I mean, the story of our founding is a great story and one we're really proud of. The Acushnet Process Company, which, you know, we're the Acushnet Company today. We're the Acushnet Process Company back in the 20s and 30s, which was a precision rubber manufacturing company. And in New Bedford, Massachusetts, Fred Bommer and Phil Young, two MIT guys, ran the company. And so the story goes, Phil Young was an avid golfer. He played at New Bedford Country Club every week. And one week in the early 30s, he was playing against a buddy of his, had a putt on the 18th hole to win the match, five-footer, strokes the putt exactly how he thinks he should. He thinks he hits a perfect putt. The ball rolls towards the hole, and it rolls offline. And so, just so you know, golfers haven't changed in 80 years. He immediately blamed the equipment.
Of course.
And so, you know, he gets into a friendly dispute with his partner, saying, there's something wrong with the product. Well, and whether it was, you know, a couple of beers at the 19th hole afterwards or what that fueled the discussion, he convinces his partner, who happened to be the head of radiology at St. Luke's Hospital in New Bedford, that there was something wrong with the ball. So they literally, a Sunday afternoon, make a their way down to the radiology department, open up the X-ray, and the X-ray of the golf ball. Well, it turns out Phil was right. The center was completely out of round. They go back the next day to New Bedford Country Club. They take a whole bunch of product out of the golf shop to borrow. They X-ray it, and they find wild inconsistencies. So Phil successfully lobbies Fred, his partner at the Acushnet Process Company, to start a side project on, I think we can make golf balls better. Not because I think I have some great innovation in, you know, technology, but sure. just because we're great at manufacturing.
Yeah.
And so that's 1932. He spends 3 years working on a process. And in 1935, the first Titleist was introduced, really under that one promise that through a better process and a commitment to quality, you're going to get a better product. And you really did. Not only were the golf balls that first came out of Titleist more consistent, but at the time, wound golf ball constructions, the path to better performance was actually higher compression, because that gave you more spin and it gave you more speed. And so the first thing that they introduced in terms of a new technology, or I should say a new process, was to freeze the liquid centers, which allowed them to more tightly wind the golf balls without the centers splitting and getting out of round. And so they were able to increase the compression, increase the performance of the ball, and deliver a better product to the market. And so if you think about that and think about process innovation, still today, if you look at what we're doing with the 2019 Pro V1 and Pro V1X, we're delivering more speed and distance in Pro V1 and Pro V1X for 2019. And a big part of that is saying we've figured out a process to make the cover thinner and add more of the casing layer, which is faster material. That was as much a process innovation as it was anything else. And really, I think those sort of core values and those roots are really, really well established at Acushnet and certainly at Titleist.
Thank you very much. Thank you for joining us today and telling us some great stories. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And I hope you enjoyed your visit to Canada, and we'll see you in the future.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks, Mike, for that great interview. It's always nice to catch up with guys from Titleist. I've always admired Titleist and the way they really stay true to their core. And I say I'm Titleist, I do mean Acushnet. And I remember one of the early reps coming up to me and talking about their mindset or their constant goal at Acushnet. It's that they are a golf ball company to begin with, and that is the core of their thought process. So if they're making shoes, which they do with FootJoy, they're shoes to walk you to your golf ball, and they obviously make clubs, and their clubs to hit your golf ball, and they make clothing so you can wear clothing while you hit your golf ball. And he always, every sentence just referred back to the golf ball, and they do not forget. And I never thought I'd see the day we saw a yellow Pro V1, but you know, they've been asking for years, and I think it's amazing.
Yeah, I haven't tried the yellow Pro V1 yet, obviously.
Well, you're getting up there in age. You might be losing the eyesight, so you might need it.
I'll definitely give it a whirl at some point this year for sure.
That's sweet. Moving on, we got a couple big tournaments this week. We're going to start with the LPGA. We have the Latte Championship, and I'm not talking coffee. Give us a quick rundown of the Latte Championship, Scotty. Where are they this week?
We'll call it the Lotte Championship.
Lotte? Is it Lotte?
Lotte.
I like Latte.
All right. We'll call it Latte, just between us. They're Koalina in Hawaii.
They're probably not sponsoring us anytime
soon.
No.
They're in the west part of Oahu, and Brooke Henderson, our Canadian, is defending champion. She that was her sixth title of her career. She won there. Obviously, she won the CP Women's Open after that, but she's there to defend this week among a contingent of five Canadians. She is there with Jacqueline Lee is there as well, Elena Sharp, Brittany Marchand, and AC Tangay as well. So that'll be some good viewing. It is a Wednesday to Saturday event, so people can catch that starting Wednesday night.
Nice, yeah, and that's the cool part. I'm looking at the start times, about 7 o'clock on Golf Channel every single night. You know, they're going to be competing with the NHL playoffs, but
give you
something to flip back and forth and check out Brooke as she goes for her eighth tournament.
She is trying to tie the all-time Canadian wins of eight wins. Sandra Post had eight for the LPGA. George Knudsen and Mike Weir both had eight professional wins as well on the largest tours in the world. So she is going to be trying to get her eighth and match that record.
Yeah, why not? Make it this week, Brooke. She also had a new signing. She signed a new 5-year agreement with CP, and also they signed her sister, her caddy, to the same agreement.
Yeah, it was pretty unexpected, I guess. I mean, we knew there would be an extension that was in there at some point, but that came through just yesterday, a 5-year agreement with her, and bringing Brittany in there as well. You know, CP can have the logo on her at the events because she's going to be there anyways. And I think for a lot of people, I think they're excited because they sort of know then that, you know, Brooke is committed to being out there for at least 5 years, and Brittany as well.
So. Oh, yeah, they'll be out there. We also have our boy Ryan DeVoe out in the field.
Yeah.
Ryan O'Toole is back out there. So we'll be cheering for Brooke, and we also got to keep Ryan squared, as I've been trying to catch on, but I don't think anyone's picking up. We're cheering for them as they go for their first title together and Ryan's first win on the LPGA Tour as well. Where are the guys at this week? Scott, we got the RBC Heritage, which is in Hilton Head, correct?
Yeah, they're at Harbortown Golf Links in Hilton Head, which is a fabulous golf course. A lot different than going and playing at Augusta. It's a lot tighter golf course. Rewards accuracy, and we have a very good contingent of Canadians there as well. And there's a big, strong connection, obviously, RBC being the title sponsor. So it's definitely a big week for Canada down there. And a lot of Canadians there. I know a lot of people that are down there watching the tournament there to cheer on the Canadian squad this week. And there are 6 Canadians in the field.
Yeah, not a lot of big names in the tournament, obviously, coming out of last week. It's to be expected. Dustin Johnson's out there, as he is an RBC player. You got Ian Poulter, Zach Johnson, and Xander Schauffele's out there as well, but not too many of the top 10 players in the world currently, or the top 10 guys on the FedEx Cup list.
Yeah, it's a pretty chill tournament. I mean, you're following on the back of a major for the other players that didn't play. They've had a week off, so it's a good chance for maybe those guys that weren't in the field at Augusta to maybe sneak in there and get a win, maybe get a first win. And most people are there kind of just relaxing. It's a really chill place. Hilton Head is really, you know, it's the epitome of the South Carolina low country. So a lot of people just enjoy hanging out there all week.
You do a lot of traveling, you know, looking at different places to go for traveling. Is it one of those places that you'd recommend for like a buddy's trip, a guy's trip down there?
Yeah,
or a gal's trip too?
Yeah. Oh, no, for sure. I mean, it's got a lot of golf courses on that island. I'm trying to think what the number is. I remember getting a total. It's dozens, but there's multiple places to stay. There's all sorts of different plantations that are there. And when I say plantation, they're basically a resort, which will have 2 or 3 golf courses at it. And, you know, so there's some good deals that way. You know, you don't always have to be trying to get onto Harbortown, which can be hard to get on and is very expensive as well. Mandatory to have a 4 caddy there. But a lot of golf courses there, a little far for some people if they're going to drive, but it's definitely a destination that, you know, you got have some good weather there. And yeah, the courses are fabulous.
I love it. But, you know, might not have to travel far to golf this weekend. It looks like courses are starting to open up here in Canada. You got any plans to get out this Easter weekend at all, Scotty?
I don't have any hard plans, but I've certainly been tracking a lot of openings. I think I'll get outside to at least maybe hit some balls on the range. I'm not sure if I'll get a round in, but I'm definitely eager to play and maybe get a golf ball in the air soon. What about yourself?
I think I'm going to try to get 2. I got the in-laws.
2? Nice.
I got the in-laws in town. They're probably listening. I apologize when I disappear for, you know, 4 or 5 hours each day. But, you know, I run a golf podcast. So I got to play golf. It is what it is. I think we're going to wrap her up there, folks. Again, we apologize for the shorter episode and potentially any quality issues, as I really don't know what I'm doing. We're just fighting through the best we can. We got a lot of good content coming up in the next coming weeks. We got some interviews. We are thinking about Nick. Nick, we hope we have you back next week, as we need our expert back. He's the only guy that got Tiger winning, right? So he's going to have some great picks for the tournaments ahead. He's batting 1,000.
He's going to do okay. Hopefully he'll pick out all the winners for the majors this year.
Oh, he's gonna go all, that'd be great, like just a nice parlay bet. Just follow Nick. He's gonna make you rich. Speaking of tournaments, we talk about it every single week. I mean, I'm not going to go too far into it, but make sure you head to flagstickopen.com and sign up for our tournament at Equinel Golf Club. Are you excited, Scotty? How's the field looking?
It's looking good. We're getting some strong players in there. I think people are finally getting their golf clubs out, so they're realizing it's only about 5 weeks away.
Nice.
So May 18th, 19th at Equinel, and the course there is getting open, I think, in the next week or so. I saw some pictures the other day, and it looks pretty good. So, yeah, so we're looking forward to that. For the Flagstick Open.
I can't wait. Nick, do not choose me to win. That will be a very wrong pick. So make sure you sign up, flagstickopen.com. Make sure you follow us on Twitter and Instagram, at Flagstick on Twitter, at Flagstick Golf on Instagram. And make sure you give us 5 stars and subscribe to the podcast. We would really appreciate that. Thanks again to everybody listening this week. We hope you get out on the golf course this weekend. Have fun out there. Shoot low. Send us some pictures on Twitter. And we'll be back next week. Have a good one.